Ricardo Ortiz is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Ricardo
Ortiz. Oops, it's one of those oops things.
The
wrong button was put. We will correct it momentarily.
Ray Hill,
so hang in with us, and we'll be right back with a new intro.
Martinez is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of David Martinez in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Dennis Longmire, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and a special guest, John Holbrook, photographer of prisoners on death row. The Execution Watch begins.
Some get good lawyers, most don't. State of Texas, killing machines.
Don't you know they're killing people?
They're scheduled to kill another one tonight. This is Ray Hill, and with me is Jim Skelton, who is going to do an analysis of the situation. Dennis Longmire is going to give us a report from Huntsville about the vigil up there. Dave Atwood is here in Houston. We have a special guest tonight, John Holbrook, who took pictures on death row and had they affected him in a very negative way. And so we're going to talk to him about the visuals of Texas executions and other things. Tonight, their scheduled execution of David Martinez, who's currently 36 years old. He was 22 years old when he killed his girlfriend, who 37-year-old Caroline Prado, and her teenage son, Eric Prado. Details of all of that is going to unfold for you this evening, and the history of the appeals and the court action in this case. At this point, we do not expect a delay. David Martinez has indicated that he didn't want any further appeals, didn't want any clemency applications. Basically, at this point, he is a volunteer. That has not always been true in this case, but at this point, he is volunteering. And you will learn all we know about that case when time arrives. We're waiting for word from Dennis Longmire, and I can tell by the action in the room that he is actually somewhere nearby. And Dennis, are you there?
Yes, I am, Ray. How are you?
I am well, and are you alone?
No, there are actually five of us on the corner.
Wait a minute. Let me.
As we're speaking, a group of four people seem to be walking up toward the corner. I don't know if they're affiliated with this or not, but there are another couple of people seem to be heading our way.
Okay. It's nippy up there.
It's a little bit chilly, but not as bad as it has been. And all of the witnesses have proceeded into the walls unit already. The media went in first, and then we counted six, maybe seven witnesses going in for tonight's
Well, yeah, they would be David Martinez's witnesses, because the witnesses for the victims in this case come in by some other route. You don't see them, do you?
The witnesses for the victims, if there are any, are already in the walls unit before 5 o'clock. And so we don't see them, but we do see the media first and then witnesses for the condemned.
Okay, so everyone's going in. You have five or seven people there.
That's correct.
And if you have any further news for us, hit Elizabeth's cell phone, and we'll have you on the air promptly.
I will do. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Dennis Longmire, who's a professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University, and he is a regular at the is a regular at the vigils in Huntsville for death row prisoners. Jim?
Yes.
Move a little microphone a little closer because you're
all right.
Live. And Jim, what can you tell us about this story?
I'd really hate to use the phrase, but this seems to be kind of a classic death penalty case. You got an instance of a kid that got started getting in trouble, and he's 13 years of age in the Rio Grande Valley, didn't finish school, got a GED.
Mm-hmm.
Started getting in trouble when he was 13. Apparently he had some type of sexual hang-up because he was caught breaking into his neighbor's house, stealing her underwear.
Mm-hmm.
And then that got him in trouble. Then he committed a series of burglaries, like six burglaries of a building when he was 16. And that got him in touch with the juvenile authorities in Hidalgo County. That's down in the lower Rio Grande Valley. And so after he was placed on probation for that, he got into some more trouble. And when he was called in for counseling after he was placed on probation, he threatened to kill the juvenile probation officer and said, if I get sent to youth, get sent to reform school and I get out, I'm going to murder you. So obviously you can tell by that at a young age, he was obviously pretty hostile, angry about something. Ends up being sent to reform school. We call it Texas Youth Council. It's still reform school. And that's kind of a, for those of us who've been around a lot of death penalty cases, it's kind of like a training school to get sent to the big penitentiary later.
Yeah, the building tenders considered that training ground so they could go in and abuse other inmates.
Kind of like ROTC for someone going to go into the Army. It's basically the same thing. So he gets out of reform school, goes back down to the Valley. While he's down there, obviously another problem crops up with women because he attempts to sexually assault a lady at a shoe store. When she comes out, he goes to shoe store in McAllen, which is a little town on the Rio Grande Valley. When she comes out at the back of the shoe store, he tries to sexually assault her. Then he's placed on probation for that.
As an adult.
As an adult. And then after he's placed on probation for that, he messes up that probation and gets sent to the penitentiary for 5 years. Then he paroles out, and when he paroles out, he eventually apparently ends up in San Antonio. And he met this older lady. In fact, they'd only known each other something like 2 weeks when he moved in with her.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the family of the lady that he moved in with did not approve of him. They didn't like him. The mother was pretty angry about it. And apparently what happened, as best you can put it together, is that after some time of him being at the house, was going to throw him out. And the evening this occurred, there were four people inside the house. There was the woman who was 30-something years of age was asleep. Her 14-year-old son was asleep on the floor on a mattress, and her 10-year-old daughter was asleep on a couch in the living room. And the 10-year-old girl is awakened by the sound of somebody hit in the head with a ball bat. And she raises up, and she can see Martinez beating her 14-year-old brother in the head with a ball bat. And she says words to the effect, you better behave yourself, you better quit that. And he told her to shut up or she'd get some of the same. And he didn't do anything to her. He then tied her up. And at that point, he'd already apparently killed the mother. He tied her up, and then he put her back in a bedroom and wrote her a note saying that he messed up and he's going to stay some friends on the east side and tied her up and left. Now, this was real, real early in the morning. But she untied herself, finally got loose, and it's around 8:30 in the morning. By this time, she goes down the street, just a few houses down to where her grandmother lives, reported what happened to her grandmother. Grandmother came back to the house, and the grandmother and grandfather saw the body of her brother, the 14-year-old Eric, dead. And they immediately called the police. When the police come, they then find the mother. She's back in another part of the house. She, too, has been beat to death with a ball bat, and there's part of brains and, you know, blood all over the house. And, of course, the little girl told them exactly what she had seen. So, obviously, they were looking for him. And some 2 weeks later, they arrest Martinez at his mother's house in San Marcos, some relative's house in San Marcos. And
wanted to know who ratted on him.
Well, that came later. What happened when the police arrested him in San Marcos, and this was kind of one of those ironical things, apparently there's another ball bat up there. And when the police started inspecting the ball bat, he said, that's not the right bat.
So there's not a lot of issue here of guilt or innocence.
Well, none whatsoever. And then what happened after he, they take him to the, and this is all voluntarily, after they take him from there and transport him from San Marcos back to San Antonio to the jail in Bexar County, when they're transporting, that's when he tells them, asks, who ratted on me? And then he made the comment that came back to later on, and every defense lawyer is horrified because you have to put up with it. He says, yeah, I killed them both like cockroaches. And then what he did, he signed a written confession, which makes, you know, this, you talk about no issues involved in this case. He's killed somebody in the presence of somebody who knew him, who identified him. He admits to doing the killing. Then he signs a confession. In the confession, he says, I think I should receive the death penalty. An ironical thing about Texas juries, when you make that request, it's very often honored. I mean, they're really good about saying, if you want to die, then we're glad to accommodate you. So what happened, not only did he confess to it, not only did he say he deserved the death penalty, not only did he do it in the presence of witnesses, he made things even better, because during jail, and lawyers always tell their clients this, whenever a lawyer gets appointed on a case like this, they know that down the line that they're going to talk to people in jail, and they caution people to behave beyond their best behavior, because you're creating other witnesses. He gets to a bunch of fracases at jail. He kicks a food tray at one of the jailers. He raises hell about some TV sets being changed and gets in some fights and scraps in jail. And then what he does to really make sure that he gets the death penalty, during the trial he threatened his defense lawyers. He threatened to kill the assistant prosecutor. And the judge had to handcuff him during part of the trial to make him behave during the jury selection. And then ironically, and this is how these things kind of flip, ironically, he then takes a stand and claims he didn't do the killing after all of this comes along, which kind of, you know, just adds insult to injury. So, of course, they promptly give him the death penalty. And so, as you well know, there's been some publicity that he waived everything. That really is not true. What happened? When somebody gets a death sentence, they have no control over it. Their case is automatically appealed.
You don't waive appeals. Your direct appeal. Do you have any decisions when you get to the habeas corpus level?
Well, you can, but he went ahead and followed that through. Because what happened, there never was any question. He never did claim he wanted to waive his right to appeal and die, because there was a direct appeal. What's interesting about the appeal, and where you normally find most of the stuff that's really accurate, because sometimes you can't rely upon newspaper articles, is you pull the opinion that the court writes when they affirm the case. And what's ironical, they've been doing more of it here lately, that when the courts hear these opinions, they have a written opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And they vote to call it published or non-published. What that basically means, when an opinion is published, that's when you see all these goofy lawyers that pose in front of law books. Mm-hmm. Those are published opinions.
Okay.
And they can be used for authority in other cases. And they usually publish most cases that are pretty important. In this case, they voted not to publish the opinion, not because of anything embarrassing about it. They just was simply nothing to write about. So there's nothing published that I could find, because that was affirmed way back in the early 90s, and there's no way to find that opinion.
Well, now, the crime, he was convicted in 94.
Right.
And the crime occurred...
The crime occurred in 1992. The opinion came out in 90. The opinion came out in 98 is when they affirmed.
Okay, so the appellate opinion came out in 98.
But see, they didn't publish it, and so when it's not published like that, there's no way that I can get access to it, because there's no place where it's placed.
Let's go back to the trial.
Okay.
Does the jury actually, you know, stand and say, you've got the execution, we're going to kill you?
No, the way it's done, and a lot of people don't understand the procedure, we've made it where it's extremely easy to give the death penalty. Let me explain why. In order to qualify to serve on a jury, you've got to promise under oath, I'm talking about the individual jurors, that they can consider giving somebody the death penalty under the right circumstances.
And that's in the jury qualification.
That's in the jury qualification.
And if they can't answer that in the affirmative, they're not on that jury.
They're not on the jury. So the 12 people on the jury have already said under oath that under a certain set of facts, they can give somebody the death penalty.
Now, before we get away from this, those jurors are struck for cause.
Yeah, if you have conscientious scruples against the death penalty and could not assess the death penalty under any set of facts, then you cannot serve on the jury, and they will strike you. That means
and
you won't
any
serve.
Any number of potential jurors can be stricken for cause.
As a general rule, this is where we have a real problem, because as a general rule, a lot of minority groups, especially African Americans, don't believe in the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that, we have a lot of lily-white juries, because a lot of African Americans just simply say they could never give the death penalty under any set of circumstances. And that eliminates them automatically. It has nothing to do with racial bias.
But that's
bias.
Because, and then after all of the jurors are stricken for cause, then both the DA and the defense can strike.
They can strike 15 each.
15 each, right. For any or no
any reason
at all.
Well, not for any reason. You cannot make a strike based upon sex, a person's sex.
Gender.
Or their gender or their religion.
Okay.
You've got some limitations, but that's really hard to prove. That's called a Batson issue. But what happens, you already have a jury getting into the box that's predisposed. It's already said, I could. It's not a jury of your peers, but it's not a group that some believe in the death penalty, some don't. All of them do. That's who your audience is. It's not your general public.
Right.
Then what happens, a death penalty capital trial is really two trials. The first trial, let's take this trial for example. The first trial is one of guilt or innocence. Now, I don't care who you are, how good of a lawyer you are, you take this set of facts.
In this case,
where a guy kills somebody in the presence of a 10-year-old girl, and it's a brutal killing where you use a baseball bat to bludgeon two people to death.
Then signs a confession.
Then says verbally, I killed them like cockroaches. Then during the trial has to be handcuffed to make him behave. I mean, there's not little doubt he's going to be found guilty. So the first part of the trial is a foregone conclusion. He's going to be found guilty, and I don't care who you are. And there's not enough words in the English language to get you out of that trouble.
That's a done deal.
Done deal. Now, after they found somebody guilty, here's where it gets kind of not tricky, but here's why I think we reasonably get so many death sentences. They don't do a deal like in the old days of Caesar, where they do thumbs up, thumbs down. In fact, the jury never uses the word death. What happens, the jury is asked a question. Do you think this person will be a continuing threat in the future? And the magic words they use is called a special issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that issue just simply says, do you think there's a probability this person will be a continuing threat in the future? Well, here, if you look at this particular case, you've got a guy who's been in trouble since he's been 13 years of age.
Yep.
You've got a guy who attempted to rape somebody when he was fairly young. You've got
his juvenile record admissible?
The juvenile record becomes admissible.
In punishment.
So the jury knew about his juvenile record. They knew that he had been given probation as a juvenile, messed that up. They knew he had been given probation as an adult and messed that up. He knew that he moved into a home with a woman who apparently did him no harm and beat her to death with a ball bat and beat her 14-year-old kid to death with a ball bat. Now, most people are going to say in their mind that person, there's a probability that person will be a danger in the future. I mean, you'd be almost dumb not to say otherwise. And see, that's kind of a convenient thing to do. The jury's not really saying, I want you to die. They're just simply answering that question. I think there's a probability you'll be a danger in the future. And based upon that evidence, it'd be hard to answer that question, no. I mean, you have to almost be on drugs to say, because you look at all that. Because what really messed up death penalty cases on that future dangerousness issue, remember the Larry O'Brien candy cane killing case? Those of you who don't remember, we had
a guy. You didn't have any more kids left to kill.
Well, what happened, those of you who don't remember, we had a man here in town who was quite religious and was well thought of in the community, apparently been embezzling money from TSO. And he'd given a whole bunch of his money to the church and to a lot of charities. And so he was about to get caught and had to be exposed as an embezzler. He had to come up with money. So what he did, he insured one of his children, then took the children trick-or-treating and had a poison candy cane given to his child, and his child ate it and it killed him. He collected the insurance money. And he did that primarily to cover the fact he'd been stealing from TSO.
Sure.
Well, he had never, ever been in trouble in his life. Never had a traffic ticket.
Yeah.
And there wasn't anything you can look back on. He didn't have trouble like stealing panties at 13, being on probation. None of this stuff. So what the courts did, they said if the crime is so heinous, that fact alone a jury can use to say that he'll probably be a danger in the future. And see, that's kind of a convenient thing to say. It's kind of like using a poker chip in a game in Vegas. That way, it doesn't seem like real money. It's a lot easier to gamble with the chip. If you put, you know, $500 on the table and you saw the $100 bills, that's more. That's kind of scary. But if you have some chips, it doesn't seem like real money. So in death penalty cases, if they don't say, well, we're not really saying he's dying, all we're saying is he's going to be a danger in the future. That's kind of a convenient way to be
able
to.
Is that the only issue?
Well, and then the second issue that's submitted is whether you intended to cause the death. And that usually comes if they have a little kind of a fail-safe thing for parties. If you're a party to an offense and you didn't actually pull the trigger, you're the non-trigger man, then there's also got to be a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that you anticipated or wanted the killing to take place. They have that issue submitted. Now, in cases where people have been abused as children and they've had a tragic background, either mental retardation, but let's take the John Penry case.
Yeah.
Penry was a case where a kid had been just treated horribly. His parents had locked him up in a chicken coop when he was a kid.
Henry Lee
burned him with cigarettes, and he had been in and out of reform schools. People had raped him in jail cells. He had a horrible background. And in cases like that, they have what they call a mitigating issue. What it basically says is, because of this man's background, were things he had no control. Horrible childhood, horrible background. Is there something about him that makes him not, in the horrible phrase they use, is not death worthy? In other words, you kind of cut him a break because he's had such a tragic background. That's called a mitigating issue. And that issue is submitted. Now, in order to get the death penalty, the jury's got to unanimously agree, all 12 of them, that the person will be a future threat. Number two, that he did an intentional act.
Mm-hmm.
And if the issue of mitigating punishment comes up and some mitigation stuff in the background, they got to believe beyond a reasonable doubt that doesn't excuse or absolve his conduct because of his background. And they answer those questions, and based upon those questions, and the judge assesses the death sentence. And so, like I say, it's convenient because a jury, they don't have to think about killing somebody. They just think about the question. Just kind of sidetracks everything. It's much like the ritual people go through in executions, because if you think about the ritual and become obsessed with their last meal and the last words, it takes the focus of the attention off the fact that you're killing somebody. It makes it a lot easier. You ritualize it.
Is that why it's such a ritualized thing?
Rituals are convenient. For example, you take Christianity. It's a lot easier to have a ritual than surrender your heart to a concept. And so I think the reason they ritualize a lot of this, why do you think they use poker chips and gambling games?
Yeah,
it seems like
sucker
real money.
Game. Yeah.
Exactly. And by the same token, you ritualize a killing, and you can kind of take your mind off what you're doing. And if you don't say thumbs up, thumbs down like they did in Caesars, but rather you answer serious
questions. Thumbs up and thumbs down would actually be more innocent. A more accurate portrayal of what's going on, right?
Be a much more honest way.
We have Professor Longmire back. Professor?
Yes.
I take it you have something to report.
Yes. The witnesses for the media and the witnesses for Mr. Martinez have just exited the Walls unit, which means that the execution has taken place.
I mean, the process has been completed.
Yes.
This is how many vigilants did you wind up with?
Six of us. I'm sorry, five of us. Yes.
We'll give our respects and thanks to those folks for their vigilance. And I suppose we're going to see or hear from you again perhaps on the 10th.
That's correct. There are two scheduled next week. I will be, of course, teaching Thursday night. I think there is one scheduled Thursday, but Tuesday and Thursday of next week. We're hoping Gloria gets well enough to be able to come back up. And so
Bless her heart, she's having knee problems, but she's getting more mobile. But thank you very much for calling. I'm talking to Professor Dennis Longmire. He teaches criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. He has been willing to be the spokesperson of the gathered folks at the vigil at the Death House in Huntsville. If you are passing through Huntsville, you can go to what they call the Walls Unit. The actual name is the Huntsville Unit, and it's on 11th Street?
12th Street. Avenue I.
12th Street and Avenue I, and you can't miss it because what you see is walls, and that's why they call it the Walls Unit, and that is where a vigil of the faithful is gathered every time there is an execution. Professor Longmire, I appreciate your being on Execution Watch.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, and I hope we get enough stays and I don't have to cope with you next Tuesday.
I agree.
Thank you, sir.
Sure.
Occasionally these executions are stayed, and there's not execution does not happen, and that's always good news to us here at Execution Watch. You're listening to Execution Watch on KPFT HD2 channel. KPFT just finished its fundraising efforts. We did not meet our goal. If you wish to help the station cover up its deficit, you can give a call to the radio station at your convenience. The number is 713-526-4000 during regular business hours is when you would do that. We've talked to Professor Longmire. We're waiting connection to Dave Atwood, who is attending and reporting from a vigil that happens here in Houston every time there's an execution. And that is ongoing down at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd Street at St. Anne's Catholic Church. Dave Atwood is with the Texas Texas Capitol the Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and he is the reporter from the other vigil. And as soon as Elizabeth can get him on the line, we'll produce him here. Okay, he is here, so I think that we've got a couple of buttons away. And David, are you there?
I'm here, Ray.
I am sad to report that the procedure in Huntsville has been completed. Professor Longmire informed us that the witnesses have exited the building, so the grisly work in the death chamber has passed. And how many folks did you have at the Houston vigil?
We had 6 adults and 2 children.
Well, that's wonderful. Let's teach a generation to be responsive and concerned about these things.
Right, right. So we had a fairly decent turnout here. Yeah, but it's sad. I've been wondering who was officiating at the and I don't know if anybody knows at the execution up there, because that if you saw that report where the warden after the last execution got into an argument with some of the officials, other officials that are there, and I think he was suspended.
He was suspended. You know that's the thing about the warden of the walls, and the reason we didn't move the chamber when they moved the death penalty from the Ellis unit to Polunsky, the chamber remained where it was because it's statutory that the warden of the walls is the governor's emissary that carries out the executions.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
part of his job description, and he is not the first warden that has been uncomfortable with that role. He may well have been the first warden that gets suspended for that.
Yeah. We didn't, you know, there were no details given about this argument, but it happened just 5 minutes after the execution. So that sort of indicates there was some relationship to what was going on there. And maybe he's getting just fed up with it. You know, I could
happening. I think I know people that have had that role. You know, I mean, I know Ken Willett, and Ken Willett is a popular warden among Texas inmates. He's highly thought of and has a good reputation, and he carried out what was in his job description. He in his book says that it was not what he looked forward to doing.
Yeah, I know. And so I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I've had a couple of experiences with that warden, Ray. He's come out one time. I was out there doing.
You reported it on this show.
Yeah.
That he came out and told you that he had some respect for what you were doing.
Right. I mentioned that. So he's. It's interesting. Anyway. Well, another execution. Boy, I tell you, it's pretty grim situation in terms of all these executions. I have to give people compliments to keep on going out there, and even Dennis Longmire up in Huntsville, who's been going out there for years and years and years. Dennis doesn't do anything loud and flashy. He just stands there at the candle and as a protest against what's happening.
Well, and your faithfulness to do that news. And by the way, a news veteran here at KPFT has slipped me a note that Warden O'Reilly was suspended for 1 week without pay and on 6 weeks probation as a result of the incident that you mentioned.
I hope we learn more about what happened at some point. I don't know if we will, but
well, I mean, you know, maybe the whole idea of executing will be something from history to be remembered, and Warden O'Reilly will write his book, and we'll know all of the details in due course. But we will look on it fondly as it marked the end of an era.
Right. Okay. Next one is on the 10th, I believe.
All right. Do you have anything to report of scheduled activities for the Texas Coalition to Abolish Death Penalty?
Well, we're going to have some things coming up. We've got one thing that we're going to do is we're going to, on early March, we're going to have a guy named Bob Van Steenberg come down to Houston and give us a program on the what things are looking like in the legislature. Bob lives up in Austin, and he's been he's basically our legislative man, working with some other people up there, and he'll be really on top of what's happening there. That's going to be on March 2nd, at the library on Montrose.
At Montrose Library in the meeting room.
At 6 o'clock. We get that space from 6 to 8, so we have to start a little earlier than we normally do, but
and that's the 3900 block of Montrose next to the Black Lab.
Right, and so that's the, and then on the, I might have mentioned this before, but on the 12th of March, we're having Tom Cahill. Well, it's the Rothko Chapel is having Tom Cahill come and talk about his book about Dominique Green. And that's going to be, he's written a book, and of course he's a very excellent author, and he is a bestseller, and this is a book that he's done that is not what he normally does. He normally writes about history, and this time he went out of the normal mode and wrote a book about a death row prisoner, and he was very helpful about getting Archbishop Desmond Tutu to come and visit Dominique when he was on death row. And then he decided to write this book with, we all encouraged him to write a book because we knew he was a good author and it probably would get a wide readership. And so he's going to be here on March 12th to talk about his book and do a book signing. And that'll be at the Rothko Chapel at 7 o'clock.
And these events are noted on www.tcadp.org, right?
Correct.
That website is TCADP, as Texas Coalition Against Death Penalty.org. Thank you very much, and give our respect and appreciation to the vigilance.
Okay, I sure will, Ray. Thank you for everything.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
And that was Dave Atwood, the executive director of TDA. CADP. Jim, this is not a pretty case.
Well, and the courts, you know, have not handled it very pretty. Like I say, the direct appeal, they decided not to publish it, and then I never could find out who did it, but after the direct appeal, somebody filed in his behalf what we call a post-conviction writ, which is that normal route that you go.
Yeah.
And I don't have any earthly idea what the issues raised in the direct writ were, because that, too, was non-published, and it was, and as well, writ works, is after the direct appeal is over with, and you can file a writ in the convicting court, and usually you're limited to any constitutional error. And the thing they usually always argue is a lawyer is ineffective. And it would be kind of hard in this case to say the lawyer is ineffective, because the test for a lawyer being ineffective, he should have done something to change the results. Well, you can't change the facts. I mean, you can hire every lawyer in the world, it doesn't change the facts. Anyway, whenever they affirmed, the trial judge recommended that the writ be denied, the Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed that, and that, too, was non-published.
Mercy.
So you don't have any earthly idea.
You have no idea. I mean, there wasn't a lot of paper wasted on this case.
They didn't kill one tree, not a sprig.
Okay. We will be back with Jim Skelton later. We have a special guest tonight, and his name is John Holbrook. John, are you there?
I'm here.
John, you're a photographer.
Yeah, that's me. Yes.
Mercy, how did you get involved in this death stuff?
Oh, it's a long story. I've been a private investigator for 17 years now, and I've worked a lot with both pre-conviction and post-conviction investigations with capital murder cases. And as like all good investigators, I have some really fancy camera equipment that I use for surveillance, and I decided one day to use it for other endeavors. And ultimately what I've done is I've photographed some of the inmates on death row in Texas. And it took me about a year to photograph, I think, about 15 inmates on death row. And I now have a series of photographs.
I saw some of your pictures. Elizabeth was kind enough to share them with me. And they did not actually let you in on the row.
Yeah, well, I wasn't on the living quarters area.
Yeah.
I only had access to the inmates where the journalists have access. I went there under journalist credentials.
Okay, and so that's basically in the high-security visiting area.
Precisely, and there's that 2-inch piece of bulletproof glass between us.
Right, as if somebody's going to get a revolver and shoot their way through it
exactly. But
what you go through and what they go through to get there.
Exactly, yeah. You know, what I'm hoping to do, you know, my photographs are the result of having worked 17 years of investigations. You know, I think my perspective about the death penalty is unique, and my argument is new, you know, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to communicate this new idea about the truth about the death penalty. My story really has very little to do with me, and in actuality, it has very little to do with the inmates that I photographed. My story has everything to do with this individual named Carrie Cruz, who was a 16-year-old girl that lived in Denton, Texas. Carrie was very physically attractive and very wise at the young age of 16, in that she believed in the abolishment of the death penalty. She was so convicted by these truths that she started her own chapter of Amnesty International at her high school.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her finest moments of her life was at Southern Methodist University when she gave a lecture about these things that she believed in. And Carrie Cruz stood in front of a large number of people, and she said very sincerely from her heart that the only way we can truly stop suffering is to love and forgive those who have caused that suffering. Now, something happens when you do something like Carrie Cruz did. If you ask yourself after the presentation is over, do I believe this? You know, do I really believe that we shouldn't kill these people? Or more accurately, if something horrible happened to me or my child, could I maintain these beliefs? And certainly Carrie Cruz asked herself that. Now, 3 days after Carrie Cruz made this presentation, she was with her boyfriend, Jesus Garza, in Denton, Texas, and they were at a place where teenagers go when they're falling in love. Shortly after that, they were approached by two men, James Lee Clark and James Brown, and for the next 4 hours, Carrie Cruz was brutalized. She was raped and tortured for 4 hours. Now, you see what's happening here. 3 days earlier, Terry Crews was asking us to forgive and not execute these same people who are now brutalizing her. And remember how she had to ask that question, do I really believe this? Now she was forced to answer this question for real. And I've spent more profound energy in my life trying to understand this story I'm telling you and understand Terry Crews. And I know with 100% certainty that Terry Crews still said yes. She still maintains her belief that these people should not be executed. Everybody who knows Terry agrees that this is the kind of person she was, you see.
Well, you're interchanging present tense and past tense in this conversation. Did she survive the brutality?
Terry Crews was murdered. Both she and Jesus Garza were murdered that night. And I think the only thing that made Terry sad was the fact that she knew she was going to be murdered, but also she wouldn't be able to tell us that she did it, you know, that she accomplished this feat of maintaining her convictions. But I believe that when you do something like Terry Crews did, it's impossible for this kind of energy to go unknown. You know what I mean? This is where the connection of my photographs come in. I was the investigator on that case. I was in charge of defending one of the men who was charged in that horrible crime, James Brown. James Lee Clark received the death penalty, and James Brown was up for trial, and I was on his defense team. I saw a bunch of horrific photographs while working that case, and as it turned out, a couple years after I concluded that case, I started to suffer from a degree of post-traumatic stress disorder. And the psychologist said it was from having worked that case and seeing the crime scene photographs. And in the process of trying to overcome my PTSD, the psychologist told me the most amazing thing. He told me, John, the only way you're going to get over this is you have to learn how to forgive the person who has caused it. And it was amazing because that's exactly what Terry Crews said. In order for me to get over my PTSD, I would have to learn how to love and forgive those James Lee Clark, the man who had caused it. And it was amazing. It worked like magic. The exact degree in which I forgave James Lee Clark is the exact degree in which the PTSD went away. She was right, you know. And this is what I'm trying to teach with my photographs. You see, in actuality, the photographs have very little to do with the inmates and has everything to do with the victims and loved ones. You see? I'm trying to teach something to the victim's family and loved ones. I'm trying to teach them what I have learned, that the only way they can stop suffering is to love and forgive those who have caused that suffering.
Well, I take it on your trail you have met Linda White.
Now, this next part, the practical approach of this, what I have learned, is really the crux of why I'm here on this radio show talking about the death penalty. You know, it's the application of this truth about forgiveness and suffering. And that has to do, in a modern-day court of law in Texas, as you know, the district attorney frequently addresses the jury and asks them to kill the human being, kill the perpetrator, because the victim's family needs closure. Okay? Now, what I'm saying is that this is a very bad thing to do, because this denies the victim's family and loved ones the ability to love and forgive that perpetrator in the future. You see, if you put the guilt of the execution on the hands of the family's loved ones, or put the blood of that man's death on their hands, you virtually deny them the ability to love and forgive. Okay? It's an injustice to execute the inmate in the name of the victim's family, because it virtually deprives them their inalienable right to stop suffering. Okay? And this is what I've learned. This is what we have to do now. Is we've always tried to educate the public in the fact that we shouldn't execute people because you may be executing an innocent man. That's the truth. We should continue to do that, but now we must also look at the victim's family and loved ones, you see. Now, let's be honest. If I was to approach Mr. Crews, the father of Terry Crews, and tell him in the height of his anxiety that he needs to love and forgive James Lee Clark to stop suffering, we have a phrase for that in court, and that's called inflammatory. And that's the truth. But the truth that I have learned, that the only way we can truly stop suffering is to love and forgive those who have caused that suffering, it is still the truth no matter what. And I believe that no matter what state of mind a man is in, when he hears the truth, it'll plant a seed deep within him that he can harvest later on to help him. You see what I'm saying?
Of course, you're speaking quite clearly.
Very good. And it's, you know, this is, you know, this is what I have learned over the years, you know, and fortunately, this truth is, you know, to use Bible verses nowadays is almost counterproductive. And although that truth I'm speaking is found in every religion, fortunately, it's found also in this, in the science of psychology. It's a quantifiable fact that the only way we can stop suffering is to learn how to forgive. Therefore, this truth can be embraced by both atheists and those of faith, you see. And because it is such a scientific truth, we're now looking at ways that perhaps we can maybe even use it in the court of law, you know, to talk about the district attorney putting the guilt on the hands of the victim's family and loved ones of the execution, you see. You know, one of the things we've learned is that you never put the justice in the hands of the victims. You know what I mean?
Well, that's Old Testament stuff.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah,
it's exactly. I mean, that's where Chuck Colson and his ministries are coming from, is that the appropriate sentencing agent should be the survivors of the victim or the victim itself.
Nonsense. That one of the first ways you determine if a civilization is civilized is you look at who deals out the justice. Is it the victims or is it society that isn't been directly victimized? And if it's the latter, you'll notice that society prospers dramatically. And if it's the former, you'll notice that society falters dramatically. You see?
Okay.
So yeah, this is...
John, I think that you've articulated with some evangelical zeal your position. Your photographs are currently on display at the Norwegian Opera House in Oslo.
For a period of time in October.
In October, and that was carried to Europe by Amnesty International.
Exactly. I had a lecture at SMU on Thursday, which was very spiritually fulfilling because that's where Carrie Cruz spoke. Uh-huh. My next exhibit will be at the state capital of Texas, which we're very excited about because it's in the heart of the battle, you see.
Yeah.
And that will be in the last week of March, we think, and it's being orchestrated by Scott Cobb, who is with the Moratorium to Abolish the Death Penalty.
It's the moratorium lobby day, actually.
Exactly, yeah, and he's going to bat for us to get those pictures in there. It's a very
You know, are you going to be in the rotunda or are you going to be in the basement?
I don't know yet. I think it's the rotunda, I hope.
Okay.
But I haven't been there to see the layout of the place. But, you know, that's a strike in the heart of...
Well, I'm familiar with all of those events that take place during those lobbying efforts in Austin for the causes.
Yeah.
But do you have a website?
Yes, I do. Holbrookphoto.com. To see the photographs I'm speaking of, you can go to www.holbrookphoto.com.
And Holbrook is
H-O-L-B-R-O-O-K-P-H-O-T-O.
.com.
That's it, yeah. And I think, you know, like I said, if anybody can get involved with the show at the CAFL, please feel free to communicate with either me or Scott Cobb with the moratorium. And
yeah, we will be making those announcements as we get closer to the event. Unfortunately, our business is rather brisk. We'll be back twice next week.
Yeah.
And so every time Texas does an execution, we do this show.
It's amazing. Yeah, what you're doing is fantastic. The irony of that is just so amazing. You know, the fact that it's the only show that strives to be canceled, you know.
Yeah, and your work is no small task.
Thank you.
Thank you, John Holbrook, for being on Execution Watch. I'm Ray Hill, and we're going to go back to Jim. Jim?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Anything we need to tidy up in this case?
The only thing that we haven't mentioned thus far, again, I could say some of the newspaper accounts said that he waived appeals. I could say that's not completely accurate because somebody in his behalf did the typical thing. They filed a writ in federal court, mm-hmm. again claiming constitutional violation.
Well, it wouldn't be unusual for this guy to I mean, at one point he said, all right, I screwed up. They said kill me, and that's the end of it. The one report that I read said he specifically said no application for clemency be put in, but that's an optional thing anyway.
Right.
But he did have a full complement Court of Appeals.
Right, because what will happen, the way you pick up this information is on the Attorney General's page, and if it was a, what we call a pro se, if it was, because here's the way it works. You're entitled to an appointed lawyer at the trial level, and you're entitled to an appointed lawyer at the direct appeal level.
Mm-hmm.
After the direct appeals, you're kind of on your own, and they've gotten some money now funding lawyers who do writs. So some lawyer or group of lawyers did a writ for him. It wasn't what we call pro se.
Mm-hmm.
And then whoever filed his federal writ, they didn't do that. That was not done by the inmate itself. It's done by some individual. And so at least they filed a writ in the San Antonio Federal District Court.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know whether there was a hearing on it or not, because, again, it was unpublished. The writ was denied, and then the Fifth Circuit simply denied an appeal of it. And I went to the Fifth Circuit webpage and could find no written opinion on the Fifth Circuit. So he did a full complement of appeals, and these were full complement appeals with counsel, apparently. And as after this process that he then said, I want to waive my right to further appeals. Well, when you say that, they just don't automatically say, okay, we're going to honor your request. They have a hearing on it.
Yeah.
And then they do that magic thing they say over and over again, is he competent?
Is he competent to make this decision?
Make this decision. And so they had a hearing in the Fifth Circuit, and after a hearing in the Fifth Circuit, they said he was competent to waive all further appeals. Now, at that point, he put his foot down and said, no more, this is it, I'm not going to apply for clemency, this is all over with, I deserve it, more or less. And that's, but he did it a full complement of appeals, although I have no earthly idea what was in them, because none of the stuff was ever published.
Okay, where do these lawyers that specialize in capital punishment ability come from? Some of them come from big law firms back east and big law firms around here?
Absolutely. You have some of your bigger law firms here, Vincent Elkins, Butler Binion, Baker Botts, that whole bunch. All of them, some of the real hotshot lawyers here in town have been real active in death penalty work. You have lawyers from all over the United States. A lot of civil lawyers have gotten involved in this. And the truth of the matter is, this whole idea that people get the death penalty because their lawyer's sleeping and nodding off, that happened some time ago, but that's archaic. Nowadays, people who try death penalty cases are very well qualified, and those that do the appeals are very well qualified. You take, for example, I'm reminded, years ago I had a client in jail, and his case was virtually impossible, and he wanted me to do all these things. And here's what I did. I got a copy of the offense report, and I gave it to him. And I said, here are the words we're going to say that you did. Then I bought him a dictionary. And I said, now here are all the words in the English language. You got a whole bunch of time in jail. You look at this dictionary and you find me some words to defend you.
Oh, okay.
And so he, after about a month, he wrote back and said, Jim, we better work a deal. And so you take a case like this, I don't care who you hire, how many people you hire, the facts of this case speak for themselves. And there's not words in the English language that could have saved this man from a death penalty.
Yeah, I mean, I keep thinking about this case. I mean, suppose you're a very competent civil lawyer and you do a lot of trial work. You understand how jury process works, but you're volunteering your time for this guy's appeal. This guy's writ appeals. They send you this file,
right?
And you open it up. What do you feel like when you read this?
As a matter of fact, when I was a brand new law student, the very first case I ever opened up was a death penalty appeal from Federal District Court to the Fifth Circuit, and I had a heart attack. I think what you do, it's not complicated. I called up the clerk at the Fifth Circuit and said, looky, I am a law student and I'm stupid. And I've got this file. Please tell me what to look for. And there are tons of people out there who will help you. And this clerk said, get a
piece of paper. Well, what was his name? Sanuta over at Texas Court of Criminal Appeals for years.
Right.
John was a guest on the prison show. Couldn't find a nicer guy. The sentence that I use most is, I can't be your lawyer in this case, but.
And believe me, you know, there is a ton, if the real key, a lot of this is digging up, getting money for a DNA investigation, things of this nature. But there is a ton of people out there. It makes you feel good. Because, years ago, I once read that the trust of a gentleman is how he treats somebody who is of no earthly value to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same thing is true of a culture. The test of a culture is how they treat that segment of our society that's really of no value to us. You take a guy like this guy, David Martinez. He's lived a life that's wrecked. Everything he's touched is wrecked. But the way we treat those people, the way we handle those people, is a test of our genuineness.
Because that's not on them, that's on us.
That's exactly right. And it's easy to be nice to, kiss butt if it's the president, but how about the guy that shines shoes? And by the same token, it's easy to be impressive and nice to people who are wealthy, but how about the poor, kind of ignorant people who get in trouble all the time? It's how well we treat the insane, how we treat the people that commit crime. It's the true test of our worth as a culture. Not how we treat the hot shots. It's how we treat the people at the bottom of the spectrum. And this, it makes you feel good, at least about humanity, when you realize that a whole bunch of people will dedicate a whole bunch of time and volunteer and give their time to do what they can to assist people, even when they know in a case like this, it's pretty much of a hopeless cause. But by God, they're going to try.
You know, listening to John Holbrook, who was, I could feel his post distress syndrome,
right,
on the microphone, and I could feel his stress and his evangelical zeal. I mean, he really had to bring Carrie's message to us, and it was important to him to bring that message to us, and he did it, I think, very effectively and very well. And I mentioned Linda White in the process, and he didn't pick up on that. But Linda White, he
was so wound up, you could have said anything. He just kept cranking.
Just kept right on going. Linda White's daughter was raped and murdered, and she went through exactly the same process. She's been a guest on this show and a frequent guest on the prison show. She is with Murder Victim Survivors for Reconciliation, and she carries with evangelical zeal her discoveries into prison and matches inmates in Texas prison to their victims for that cause. There are some wonderful people out there doing wonderful work. Why aren't we listening better?
I think we are listening better. If you look at what's happening now, we have much fewer death penalties now. I think it takes time, Ray. The courts are always about 5 years behind social movements, and it takes time. For example, people found out a lot quicker than our juries found a lot quicker than prosecutors did that marijuana is not the evil everybody said it was.
Right.
And so you always have a lag time with our court system, primarily because our people who serve on the bench is our judges. Are really elected officials, and they're just scared to death they're going to have to be thrown out of office and do something honest for a living. And what they're going to do is kind of go with the flow. And our court system for years have always been pretty much behind how the society feels. Society, I think, is much more understanding and liberal about these cases than our court system have been, and we're slowly catching up with that. I think it'll be some lag time, we're catching up. For example, we had a couple of cases this week. Gal kills her baby. They don't even seek the death penalty in it. Give the death penalty on a guy up in McKinney, Texas. He shot and killed four people.
Mm-hmm.
They did give one death sentence this week. But it's changing.
But the numbers in Texas are changing.
Absolutely.
Dramatically.
Real dramatic.
That report is out. And the number of executions that went to the death penalty or scheduled executions is down. The number of executions themselves everywhere except Texas is down. Another state is awaiting governor's signature in New Mexico. The legislature has passed the abolition bill, and it has not been signed by Governor Richards, but I think everybody expects Governor Richards to sign it. This has been Execution Watch. And we have a website. Some of you are watching or listening to us on the website. Others are listening to us by KPFT HD2 channel. The website is executionwatch.com.
www.thefreedomtexas.org, and we encourage you to go there. We have an archive of the shows that we have done. Tonight's show, we had the execution of David Martinez. I'm Ray Hill. Jim Skelton is our legal analyst and commentator. John Holbrook, the photographer, called in. In between that, we talked to Dennis Longmire, who was our reporter from the Vigil in Huntsville, and David Atwood, who is with the Texas Coalition to Abolish Death Penalty, and their website is so identified, and he was from the Vigil here in Houston. We would not be able to do this show without the hard work of Elizabeth Stein. She is our executive producer, and of course we couldn't do it without the electronic wizardry of excuse me. Oh, sorry about coughing in your ear like that, because in the other room, in tied up doing all of that, is McClay, and he is the one of the wizards here. Both of those folks can be reached here at the radio station, and we are going to honor the recognition of Death by Texas, which was the song we played earlier, written by Victoria Panetti. I'm Ray Hill. Good night.